Welcome to the Conquering Truth Podcast. I'm Dan Horn.
I'm Jonathan Sides.
I'm Charles Churchill.
And I'm Joshua Horn.
And tonight we want to talk about stimulus checks. The government has passed a bill to send stimulus checks out to the citizens. And how should Christians be thinking about this? Should we take them? Should we refuse them? And I think the first thing to talk about is, should the government be sending them?
So when you ask a question like that, there's a couple of things that you've got to do. One of them is just say, well, what's the role of government? What kinds of things should the government be doing? And then you have to talk about the thing itself and say, they say that they're giving us a stimulus check. What do they mean by that? What are they trying to stimulate? And then put that back in the context of what you've already discussed about what should the government be doing in the first place.
So what should the government be doing?
So I think the Bible defines what the role of government is. That's controversial in some Christian circles, unfortunately. But really, if all of life is supposed to be based on the Bible should tell us the role of government. If God is setting the civil magistrate as an authority in place over us, in the Scripture, we should find what the limits are to that authority.
And even with that authority, the issue is that, you know, Romans 13 says that they're a deacon of God, they're a servant of God. And so when we think about it, it's not even that God appointed it. I mean, it is God appointed it, but it's even further than that. He appointed it to do his service, to do the things that he wants it to do, and not to do whatever's right in their own eyes.
I think 1 Peter 2:13 through 14 is one of the clearest verses on what the government is supposed to be doing. That says, therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. So we have two things there, punishment of evildoers and praising those who do good. So I think the question is to address first is, does the government sending out checks, does that fall under punishing evildoers or praising those who do good?
Seems pretty clear it doesn't fall under either of those. Now, it and part of this is, as we think of those things, we have to recognize part of the reason that they say they're doing it is because they've done other things, right? They've done the lockdowns. They've forced quarantines. So can you say that the quarantines are somehow the punishment of evildoers? So therefore, I don't get that, but somehow you'd have to tie their first step in because they say they're doing it in reaction to the first step. That their first step was to lock people down, and because of that, they've destroyed the economy, and so therefore they're going to try to recover the economy.
Right, but they're sending it to everyone, whether you're doing good, whether you're doing evil, whether you're doing nothing, it's to everyone.
So if it's anything, it's to compensate for the evil that they're doing, in a sense.
Right, and it's not even really the evil that they're doing, it's people have been put in a difficult place, and we think we can get a benefit from helping them. You know, I mean, it's people have had a hard time, and if we send them money, no one gets mad at you for doing that. And in fact, they're frequently grateful. I mean, there's not a really good argument that flows from what Scripture says a government should do as to why they're doing it.
Especially when it's universal, right? I mean, and I'm not saying that they should do it anyway, but if they did something, for instance, they go to war, and in going to war, they take somebody's goods to go to war, they should compensate them for it.
Right.
And part of their argument, I think, that would be we've done damage to the economy to do good, which isn't the scriptural verse. It's to the praise of them who do good. But to do good by stopping the pandemic. And so therefore, we should try to restore them, to try to make them whole from the loss that they suffered. In war, we would see that, right? You go to war and somebody says, we're going to take all your horses. It's long enough ago to go to war, they would pay them for the horses. They would pay them for the wagons. And that was a very common practice. And so I think part of how they're looking at it.
How they're justifying it.
Or justifying it might be a better right. term, is they're saying we're making whole people that we damaged.
Though an important point here is that the federal government is not the one that's been putting lockdowns in place. So all this damage that people are attributing to the lockdowns, 99% of it is not coming from the federal government. And they're the ones sending out the checks.
Right. So they end up are saying that because we were encouraging something, we therefore have now taken this as an obligation to deal with the consequences of it. I mean, I find it to be a pretty weak argument.
Right. I mean, it's in a real sense, when you look at what's been going on, there's a part of it where the coronavirus came from the hand of God. And the coronavirus is, I mean, no matter what, it is a judgment of God. You could argue what it's a judgment of, but in the sense, judgment really just means decision. And so, I mean, it's the decision of God. God says this is an equitable thing to do to people. God is a good God. God is not unjust. And so God is saying this is worth doing to people. This is what he wants to do. And in response, the government is saying we can step in and we can fix the things that God has done. We can, you know, they've caused this harm because of what God has done. I mean, in the end, it really is it has a lot to do with the nation's view of what God does and how those things should be dealt with.
I think they understand what God does, which is God is the provider, God is the lawgiver, God is all these things that the government is trying to play God.
Right.
And so they're saying, because God has made people sick, we have a duty to make them well, because God is the one who makes sick and God is the one who heals. And so therefore, as government, we have the responsibility to heal them. Because they've lost their job, we have the responsibility to provide for them. Right. And so the government, in doing this, I think it more starts, rather than making somebody whole, which seems to me that there's a legitimate case that you can argue that there's times to make people whole. But instead, what the government is actually doing is playing God.
So, Dan, you say that this is the government acting as God. They're playing the role of God. Can you unpack that a little bit? Exactly how is it that by the government mailing a check, they're being God?
Right. And specifically what they're saying is that they can deal with the suffering that's common to man is part of it, and that they can provide, that they can create something from nothing, that by sending these checks, that somehow this will actually cause people to have stuff, and this is how they'll feed themselves and everything else. You know, the Lord's Prayer says, you know, give us this day our daily bread, and this is what we're supposed to pray to God for. And instead, the government's saying, look towards us for our daily bread.
And a huge percentage of what our government is doing that, trying to replace the role of God or the role of other institutions that God has made. You know, welfare, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, all of these are the government trying to say, you know, we're going to take away all suffering across the board. And you look at some of those areas, God designed for the family and the church to do it. Areas where there's a lot more accountability, where you actually know the people. It's not people in Washington making rules to try to apply things to 300 million plus Americans. It's a church of 100 people saying, how can we minister to the people we know in our community?
And if you go back to you know, what Peter wrote, is that it's about constraining evil. It's about stopping evil. That is not that much of the government, and especially not that much of the national government. The national government, you could say it has a role of national defense to stop people from coming in, but everything else it does is really against Scripture. And it's really important because when it does something that's against Scripture, like Medicare, where it's saying we're going to provide for people, that we're going to provide health care for people, what it's saying is that people should applaud the government for doing that. And so it's stealing glory from God. And God is a jealous God. And so our government wants people to worship it, which we've seen a lot of that over the last, you know, over my lifetime, but it's increasing rapidly where people are looking towards even the attack on the Capitol.
Yes.
The response to it is related to people worshiping the government. Why is it that much worse to attack that building than it is to burn down downtown Portland? Well, it's worse because you touched the God of America. And so when the government starts to do things that it hasn't been given the right to do, it's stealing glory from God. And God is a jealous God, and as a nation, we should expect judgment of God when our nation wants to be God, when our government pretends like it's God.
Right. There's a part of it where the attitude is, you know, I mean, this can be true of even things like insurance. This can be true of a lot of things. There's a part of it where a person says, God could do these things to me, and I want to protect myself from the wrath of God. And so there's a part of it where, in a sense, when you see government and the attitude of it, is the people band together to protect themselves from the judgment of God. And I'm not saying that this is always the heart desire of something like that, but I'm saying it very easily can be. It would be like a child trying to do something like for spanking insurance. You know what I mean?
We'll all get a light spanking rather than one of the children getting five whacks.
Right.
Each one of the five will get one.
Right.
And you distribute the punishment.
Right. And there's this part of it where if you're God and you look at a people and they're doing this, I mean, God says, if I'm going to judge you, I can do whatever I want. So in a sense, I mean, there's this part of it where there's a foolishness in the thinking, but there is a part of it where that's the way people think, is how do we protect ourselves from the judgment of God? Because they don't deal with these things in that way. They don't even ask themselves, could it be God judging us? They're like, we need to make sure that if he does something, we're protected. We'll protect each other. I mean,
And it doesn't work either. You look at, you know, the war on poverty, trillions and trillions of dollars spent, and the statistics on poverty not changing.
Right.
You look at even the response to the coronavirus. You look at the charts, and you can't tell in the chart when they put the number of cases. You can't tell when they put the lockdown in, because all the government's efforts cannot thwart what God is doing.
And we have to recognize that God judges this. All you have to do is read scripture to see how God judges this. This is the Tower of Babel, right? We'll build a tower and we will be in the heavens like God.
Right.
Right. It is man wanting to be God. This is the Babylonian Empire. This is why Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue that everybody bows down to. Man wants to be God. And we look and see how this ends up. God doesn't sit back dispassionately and go, oh, you know, they're trying to play God again. We don't care. No, God says, this is a cause for my wrath.
And going back to the Tower of Babel, they built it. It's the next story in your Bible, more or less, after the flood. And you're building a tower that will reach up into the heavens so that you can be safe from another flood. Which means, on the one hand, you don't believe God's promises, where he says he won't do that again. But you're also trying to use your own means to protect yourself from the judgments of God, which never works.
Never works, but God, in his chastisement, can make it appear to work for a season. We've impoverished ourselves thinking that we can destroy poverty. You go back, you know, to the 40s, and we loaned to many, many nations, right? During World War II, the Lend-Lease program, we were lending money to, we basically took all the gold from all the nations between World War I and World War II because we were loaning to nations. And now, how many trillion in debt are we? This is the war on poverty. We have impoverished ourselves. We set the trap saying we can be God and eliminate poverty, and we have properly fallen into it as a nation, and now we are very poor with the appearance of being very rich.
Right. We are still one of the wealthiest countries in terms of standard of living and a lot of other things, but you can't do that forever. You can't escape. You can't be trying to put yourself in the place of God and acting as a status country forever.
And I think it's worth, I mean, and this is not the point of this, but it's worth tying it back to the church's response to the coronavirus, in the sense of, instead of coming to God in meekness and in humility, the church has tried to avoid what God has been doing. We won't meet together. We won't join together. And so, I mean, it's the same thought process that's driving some of those thoughts. So, I mean, I don't want to take us too far off track, but there is this part that you look at the church's response, and it's a very similar response.
And, I mean, one of the ways that you can get, you know, professed Christians mad at you is you walk in, if they're sick or if there's a pandemic or if there's, and go, God sent this, you should ask yourself how you're being judged. Professed Christians get really mad at the idea that God would send pestilence as judgment because they hate the Bible. Because
right.
The reality is, it's repeated over and over in the Bible, right? When God judges David for doing a census, he says you have three choices. You can have war, you can have pestilence, you can have famine. These are God's standard judgments. When you see pestilence, when you see sickness in the world, the question that should always be, how have I sinned? How has my family sinned? How has my church sinned? How has my state sinned? And ask yourself, because, you know, in Deuteronomy 28, God says, look, if you obey me, you won't get the diseases of Egypt.
Right.
But if you don't obey me, you will get the diseases of Egypt.
Right.
So we want to separate sickness from sin, and that is not what Scripture does.
So if you start with two really basic premises, that the government shouldn't be doing certain things because the Bible is sufficient, and the Bible gives us it gives us everything that we need for life and godliness. If you really want to start with the sufficiency of Scripture and say that in the sufficiency of Scripture it talks about what the government should be doing, then it seems pretty clear the government shouldn't be doing things that are manipulating the economy. But moving on from that, what is the government doing when they say, you know, just mechanically, here's a stimulus check for you? What's the intention behind that? And then what practically actually happens when that act goes into effect and all of this new money is circulated among the populace?
I think you see, we've seen like the Black Lives Matter riots over the summer. We saw the Capitol get invaded. And one thing that's happening is people are getting really angry at being locked down. So I would argue that the reason that they're doing it is they want to give bribes to people so that they'll behave the way they want them to behave. And that we should be thinking of the stimulus checks as bribes, that the national government, the U.S. government, is trying to bribe the people so that they accept the decrees that are unrighteous, because people are having trouble accepting them.
Now, you can say that, but I mean, I haven't read a single news article anywhere where I've seen any politician quoted saying, hey, I'm going to bribe the American people. So,
because politicians are renowned for their honesty and their forthrightness.
Well, sure, yeah, but if it's that obvious, how do we get there? What is it? How is it working like that, so that it's functioning like a bribe?
Right. The Bible says that a gift perverts the judgment of the righteous, and so the government is giving us gifts to pervert our judgment, and so even though the government is never going to say that's why they're doing it, why would they give it to everybody? It's one thing to say we're going to help those who are hurting, but most people, their expenses have cut down, right? You don't have to commute, what's the average commute, like 42 minutes or something, last time I read, which might be 10 years, 20 years ago, but it's like 42 minutes each way. All of a sudden, you stay home, you have a lot of extra time. All of a sudden, your expenses, you can't travel. You don't need extra money, except for the 16% or so that lost their jobs to begin with. Everybody else is actually financially better off. So why would the government send money to people who are financially better off unless it's a bribe?
Right. I think looking at the news over the past 9 months, I think the bribery is not that hard to see. You see where, you know, even just the amount of time they spend talking about the stimulus checks. Like, I know, like, I would go open the news app, and every single day, it seemed like there was an article saying, how much will we be getting in the next stimulus check? When will they be voting on the next stimulus check? I mean, the amount of focus and the number of articles written. I mean, I don't know how many it is, but it must be thousands and thousands of articles written. When is the government going to give us more money? And then even, you know, they're saying, you know, this Republicans lost Georgia. Why? Because they wouldn't give $2,000. They only gave $600. You look at the number of conservative people saying, well, they gave this many million to all these foreign countries and only $600 to me. I mean, that's bribery, saying, well, I don't have a moral problem with what the government is doing with all the trillions of dollars they're spending. I have a problem that I only got $600.
I think especially Biden was, you know, President-elect Biden was very forthright in what he said when he went to campaign in Georgia, which is, if you don't vote for these two Democrats, you won't get your $2,000 check. I'm not sure how you can make a statement that's not more obviously a bribe than that statement. That's right. What he said to them. You vote for these people, you will get a $2,000 check. You don't. Seems very clear that it's bribery.
I mean, it's been one of the first election cycles I remember, and I mean, since the bailouts that happened, under George W. Bush, that where on the Republican side, where there were people really promoting the sending of money to individuals. I mean, it's been something that's always been a no on the Republican side. And now this is the first real election cycle where you've seen it promoted as, we should do this and we should keep doing this, and, you know, and this is a good thing, and maybe we should give more money. And so, but it is one of those things where, honestly, in my head, anytime I hear the government talk about it, my thought is, I think a lot of people do, oh, it's just politicians buying votes. I mean, and so there is a part of it where that's always bribery. You know, I mean, when anytime the government decides we're going to spend the government's money on you so you'll think better of us, that's what it is.
And you just said something, right? the government's money.
Right.
What money does the government have?
Exactly. It's always the people's money.
The government has no money.
Negative.
The government owes money, so the government doesn't have money to spend.
So the money that we get when we get a check, where's that value? Where's that wealth coming from?
So I mean that's really what we're talking about. It's not like the government has got some big vault somewhere where they have piles of money.
Fort Knox has been empty a long time.
That they go into with wheelbarrows, and then they come out with those wheelbarrows and start shipping. You know, it's not like that. There's nothing physical going on. For many people, they don't actually even receive a paper check. They're just getting an electronic adjustment in their bank account with direct deposit. Some people are getting a check, but you know, where's that coming from? Literally speaking, where's that coming from? It's being invented. Somebody's just saying, hey, there is now this much more money in the money supply. And that's it. That's all that's happening.
And it's drastic. It's really drastic. I mean, the amount of money that they're printing. I mean, if you look at a chart of how much money is in all the banks, which if we had a fair currency would stay flat. I mean, it goes up dramatically. And you look at, you know, 2020, when there's a $3 trillion deficit, you see a big spike. So the amount of money that is out there is going up. And that means that all the money you have is losing value. Because if there's $100 out there and suddenly they put $1,000 out there, now all your money cannot buy the stuff that it could buy before.
Why is it that all of a sudden there's all this more money out there that's available for people to use? And that one of the stated intentions of a stimulus check is we can stimulate the economy by injecting a whole bunch more cash into it, even though it's not cash, it's just ones and zeros. We can give this to people so now people can go out and they can buy goods and services with it and keep the economy going. How is it that that's a problem?
The issue is that it's inflation, and there's lots of discussion of what inflation is, right? Inflation is you have X number of dollars and you blow the balloon bigger, you inflate it. So if there were $3 trillion out there and you print $2 trillion, you have 60% inflation, 67% inflation. And it is expanding the amount of money. Now, the reality—
Doesn't that mean we can just buy more stuff?
No, because the reality is that money is representing value. And when you increase the size of it, the value doesn't increase. It doesn't produce anything. Production is what produces things. Work is what produces things. When all you're doing is sending bits and ones and zeros to change somebody so that they have $600 more than they did before. The reality is that the underlying wealth hasn't changed. So you now have more dollars chasing the same underlying wealth, which means that the price of everything goes up. It's basic supply and demand. So that first dollar that's spent, when the government prints it, if you have $1,000, that first extra dollar is still worth the same as those $1,000. But by the time it floats around, it's absorbed, and now the value represented by that $1,000 is now represented by $1,001. And if you do that with $1,000, that first time you spend it, everybody receives it, and they think they got full value. They think they got a dollar. But after a while, after the whole 2000s in circulation, you'll have 50% inflation because you doubled your money supply, or 100% inflation. And so now all of a sudden it takes $2 to pay for something that used to take $1. Now, a lot of this has been hidden in our economy because our productivity has been going up. But the government, by printing money, has been stealing all the productivity and the increased productivity in the United States for a long time. Because the inflation, what it should be is, if you have a fixed number of dollars and your production goes up, those dollars all become worth more. But they become dramatically worth less. I think we have a graph that shows from the times, I think it's from 1950, of how much a house cost. And in real dollars, if you take it and eliminate the inflation, it's about the same. But you see it skyrocket. It's gone up from I think, $5,000 or something like that to $150,000. That's a 30-fold inflation over that period. That's stealing from the productivity of all those years that's been stolen from our country so that the government, by printing that money, ends up transferring the wealth to itself of the increased productivity. And our country has had unbelievable increase in productivity over those last 70 years. but it's all disappeared because money is worth less than it used to be. And that's inflation that's eating it up.
And I think it can be helpful to understand this if we kind of take it to the extreme, which is hyperinflation. So my grandparents, so we have the first ever prop on the Conquering Truth. So this is from Zimbabwe. It's from 2008 or so. My grandparents brought it back from Africa, and it's a $500 million bill from Zimbabwe. So they didn't print a $500 million bill because they love zeros in Zimbabwe. When they first came out with this currency in around 1983, one Zimbabwe dollar was equal to one U.S. dollar. So if you had 500 million Zimbabwe dollars, you would have been probably the richest person in Zimbabwe by far. But in 2008, when my grandparents were there, this was worth $1. So if you worked very hard, were extremely successful in Zimbabwe, and made $500 million in Zimbabwe dollars and put it in your bank account, in 2008, you would have literally nothing. And so that's what happened. All that wealth that you worked was stolen by the government because they started putting out money. And they put out higher and higher denominations because people got less and less trust in the money supply. There was more and more money out there. Till finally, it went to hyperinflation. And it's bad when that happens. That means that there's a lot of suffering, a lot of people losing their money. There's usually war. There's governments being overthrown. It's a bad situation because it's a country that's lawless. It's a country that is relying upon false weights and measures. And that lawlessness manifests itself in a lot of areas.
And it's, you know, when we think of what governments do in terms of, you know, punishing evil, one of the most basic ways that evil is to be punished is to have true weights and measures, right? I think it's in Hosea that it says that they can't wait for the Sabbath to be over because as soon as the sun is set, they'll go out and they'll use two different shekels or two different weights, one for buying grain and one for selling grain. And that's diverse weights and measures, right? It says in Proverbs 20:10, diverse weights and diverse measures, they are both alike an abomination to the Lord. How many people think that ANSI, which is American National Standard Institute, is one of the biblical parts of the U.S. government? Most people don't think that, but it's the one that says a foot is a foot, a mile is a mile,
a pound is a pound,
a pound is a pound, an ounce, when they have ounce on their, you know, on your little bottle, that's ANSI that said, this is what it is. ANSI is one of the few parts of the federal government that is actually biblical.
But what they don't say is a dollar is a dollar.
What they don't say is a dollar is a dollar. Because what they say is we can use false weights and measures, but we're going to stop everybody else from doing it. But the reality is that is part of what God's judgment is because it is an abomination to the Lord.
Right.
We even forget what a dollar is. A dollar was the common currency at the time of the Constitution being written. It was the Spanish currency. And the first thing they did after writing after approving the Constitution was go out and collect a bunch of Spanish dollars, weigh them, and say a dollar is X amount of weight of gold and X amount of weight of silver. A dollar is a weight.
Right.
We look at a piece of paper and we think this is a dollar. No, a dollar is a weight. What does that have to do with a piece of paper? Well, what it has to do with a piece of paper is false weights and measures.
Right. So this is fiat currency, currency that's based on nothing real. Because they did have dollars where, you know, your paper bill represented an amount of gold in the bank. But for a long time, that has not been the case in the United States or in basically no other country in the world. And, you know, there are always ways for them to play with the money supply and do literal false weights and false purities of money. But recently, in the grand scheme of things, they've come up with this new way where they're just giving out pieces of paper and saying, if you don't accept this as valuable, we're going to throw you in prison for tax evasion.
So because you won't accept a false weight and measure, we're going to constrain evil. But it's not evil because the false weights and measures are evil. And woe to a nation, woe to those who call good evil and evil good. And when we say, we will point a gun at you and we will arrest you if you refuse to accept this piece of paper and call it a weight, that is something that we should expect our country to be judged for, and we are being judged for it. We shouldn't deny it. It's very obvious we're being judged for it as our wealth is being taken away by the government.
I mean, we should expect in our lifetimes, at least for the younger ones of us, it's very likely.
Thank you, Joshua.
it's very likely that I can put a 500 million Zimbabwe dollar on my wall and right under it a $500 million U.S. dollar bill on my wall. I mean, you know, I the numbers are complicated, and some of the reason is because they want to hide it. But, you know, in the fiscal year ending in September 2020, I think they spent $6.6 trillion, but only got in $3.3 trillion. And you look at the amount of money, and that's like 20% inflation. So all of the money that you have in the bank will eventually lose 20% of its value based on what they did in 1 year.
Which is pretty big. I think one of the things that's important is, so some of these concepts, they seem complicated. And part of the reason why they seem complicated is because they don't teach them in school really anymore. They used to teach them in school. They're not, the church really doesn't have, the church doesn't emphasize critical thinking skills. I mean, so one of the things, we'll try to have a link to a video below in the, you know, below our, below this episode. Yeah, to actually have about, if you want to learn more about like money issues and monetary policy and how inflation actually affects things. The other way is one thing I think that's useful is if you think about it from the perspective of at your job, it would be very much like if an employee put in that they worked more hours than they actually did. Imagine if every week an employee could put in that they worked 40 hours and they didn't work 40 hours. And the next week they could put in that they worked 80 hours. And the next week they put in that they worked 120 hours. There'd be a point where bosses would start paying less money for every hour that you worked and you would start chasing each other. I mean, this is basically the same concept. And it's what happens when a person lies and says they work more hours than they should. So, I mean, some of these things, they actually happen all the time around you and even people are involved in them. But they're not ridiculously complicated if you understand the concepts.
So when the government goes and prints a whole bunch of money and they have money out there already, when they spend that first dollar, they say it's worth the same as what's there. But they actually know they've already inflated the currency. They know it's not worth that. And yet they're deceiving the American people by paying with money that they know they have devalued because they've already printed the money. They've already said this is how much money we're going to print. And so they're devaluing it, but yet they're giving it to people saying it has the same value. We should just recognize how evil this is. And we should recognize how much the church loves it. Because the reality is when you do this, the biggest thing that most people have in their lives in terms of financial is their house. And so if you have a, like when I was growing up, my parents had a very nice house. We had a $16,000 house. And, you know, that house now is worth $300,000. But if you had $16,000 mortgage on that house, and you didn't pay the mortgage off, you just paid the interest, you got a free house after 50 years. Because that house, it's now worth $300,000, you still just pay $16,000 for it. So by inflating it, if you embrace debt, then inflation all of a sudden means that you're not paying back what you owe either. You're only paying back a fraction of it because the government has said false weights and measures are fine. So the American people accept it and embrace that it's fine to have that mortgage where the inflation makes that money worth a lot less than it used to be. You get a big raise, and now all of a sudden, right, when they do mortgage loans and stuff, the first thing that they do is say, how much can you do now? Because if you can do it now, you probably won't have any problem paying it off because they know the inflation, that right, the money will be inflated.
But like Joshua said, if somebody else had $16,000 in the bank and they held onto that $16,000 in the bank, they couldn't buy a house. And, you know, I mean, their money, their value would have been stolen from them by keeping that money in the bank. And so, I mean, it's right. I mean, it's,
so you can see really easily why this would be an abomination in the sight of God.
Right.
And so now let's get back to the stimulus checks. So yeah, how does this tie?
So getting back to the stimulus checks, just summing up everything, more or less, if I understand your explanation, what you're saying is that the amount of value that's out there that you can use money for to purchase, goods and services, things that you want, things that you need, is going to more or less remain static overnight.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, it changes over time, but overnight it's not changing. And now we're going to throw a whole bunch of money at that, that at some point, maybe very quickly, the market out there is going to understand that there's a whole lot more measures of value, meaning dollars, but there's not a whole lot more things of value. So eventually they're going to, you're going to see prices rise. So here's what I'd say. It doesn't sound like you're actually stimulating the economy when you do this, because the economy is just what's out there that you can buy and sell. And now you're giving a whole lot more money, but that money's not worth any more
In fact, it's worth less.
And see, and it used to be, I mean, some of the stimulus, the way they would stimulate it is one of the big problems was a lack of currency, right? I mean, this is why they go to dollars. This is why they go to bills. Mm-hmm. Because one thing is those each coin can get to be a lot of money if there's very little gold and there's lots of value. And then what it gets to be hard is to trade because you can't get that gold to trade. And so what you end up doing is trade stagnates. So what they would actually do is start to print money, because if you put money in there, all of a sudden people can trade. And so it stimulates the economy because people can say, I want this more than I want this. And you have a third way to exchange it through. And so it can grease the economy and stimulate in that sense. But it's been a long time since we've been talking about stimulating the economy in that sense. Because what we think now is if people go out there and spend stuff, then people will produce more. And when they produce more, they'll pay more taxes. And then they can give more, and et cetera. And it's this stimulation of production. But even if that theory is correct, I think there's lots of reason to think that theory is not correct. But even if that theory is correct, if you've shut down manufacturing because there's a pandemic going on, what production are you trying to stimulate? So to stimulate is the idea that we can make it easier for the economy to produce more. We increase demand is what they say now. Before, it used to be that they made it so it was easier to exchange, so that you didn't have to do barter of everything. But now you're stimulating businesses that you're forcing to be shut down. It's not going to work. It can't work because you force them to shut down. How do you stimulate production when you're saying you can't produce?
And that's what you were saying, in a sense, is it's a bribe. It's you're paying people to be comfortable with the decisions they've made to shut you down. People would be angrier if they didn't give them the money.
And I think that's really clear. And so all that to say, how should Christians think about it now that we've talked about?
Is it wrong to take the money?
Fundamentally, if it's a bribe, how should we think about whether a Christian should take it or not?
I mean, the first step is to not treat it as a bribe, meaning the people who put this in place, the people who voted for this, they are, I mean, actively destroying the country. Now, there's a lot of people who are doing that. A lot of people who are doing that through sin.
There's plenty of that going around.
Yes, but you know, they are actively violating their oaths of office, because the Constitution gives a short list of things the government is supposed to do. Nowhere in there is send people money. Nowhere in there is create a fiat currency.
But what about the general welfare clause?
Well, yeah, there's a list of powers. That's in the preamble, saying the goal of government is to produce the general welfare. It doesn't mean that you can use that to override a list of powers saying this is specifically what the government can do, and anything not in this list is left to the states. So the general welfare clause is like a mission statement. You can't use your mission statement to override your constitution. So you have these people in office who are sending this to you as a bribe. So the first thing is, don't vote for those people, because they're violating their oath of office. And if you vote for them, you are supporting an oath breaker. You're supporting someone who has no testimony of the fear of God in their life, because one of the most, you know, solemn things they have done in their life, taking the oath of office, they've violated. And they, if they're voting for this, they're most likely routinely violating it in office, because there's a lot, so many things outside the scope of this discussion that are horrible that the government's doing.
The church takes the name of God in vain, in the sense that we let people break oaths and we don't care. Most of them take the oath. There's one that takes it on the Quran, I think, maybe a few more now. But the rest of them take the oath on the Bible. They're taking the name of God, and they're saying, I can walk away and not do anything, not consider it at all. They immediately usually take their oath of office and then turn around and vote on the rules, which are very unjust and very impartial, and they're very contrary to the Constitution. They immediately break the Constitution.
Right.
And the church doesn't go, these are evil people. And so they don't see God as the judge, the just judge, that if you take an oath, there will be judgment. And we're a country under judgment. We need to stop pretending like we're not. We're a country under judgment, and we deserve the judgment, because the church actually doesn't think oaths matter.
And it applies to the personal life. People don't take business contracts seriously. People don't take
marriage
vows seriously. I mean, they don't want to hold the federal government officials to their oaths of office because they don't keep their word and they like the bribes.
And the church doesn't take church covenants seriously, which is an oath when you join the church. And the church doesn't take it seriously. And we can't expect our civil magistrates to walk in the light when the church walks in darkness, when the church won't do church discipline, when the church says people can take an oath and then they just ignore it and nobody cares. We should expect judgment because God cares about his name. And when we ignore oaths, we're saying the name of God doesn't matter.
I mean, it's gotten to the point where, I mean, a few years ago, we had a contract with the state, with another state. And there was an issue where in our contract it said this is what we were going to do. And they came to us and said, well, we don't want to do that. And they say, how about we don't do it this time? How about we don't do it? But I can promise you in the future we won't do it again. And he's like, you know, and it was like, well, I could send you a letter saying that we won't do it in the future. And I'm like, I already have a document from you that says you won't do it. And it's the contract we have. I mean, and literally, I remember on the phone with him saying, if we accept this right, you know, right now, I should expect you'll always break your word because I've told you that I don't care what you do. And so we drew a line right there. They didn't do it. And it actually never came up again. But if we had stepped over that line, that's exactly what would have happened because I would have told him, what you said doesn't matter, and he would have agreed what he said didn't matter. And I mean, the church, and that's what you're saying, is in the church, how many times does someone in the church, something happens, someone gets caught in sin, something, and that people in the church go, well, I mean.
And we need to recognize the seriousness of this. I mean, when, after Saul dies, David sees people dying in Israel, and he goes, why are these people dying? And he goes to the Lord, and the Lord says they're dying because they, because Saul persecuted the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites were, a covenant was made between Joshua, long time before, Joshua and the Gibeonites, that the Israelites would protect them, and Saul abused them. And God says, I'm going to judge Israel and start to kill people because 700 years later, 500 years later, whenever it was, Saul abused them. God takes those seriously, and the church doesn't, and we can't deal with divorce in the church. We can't deal with civil magistrates that won't keep their oaths. We can't deal with these things unless we say, first and foremost, the oath to the church really has to matter. So if they've broken their oath of office by voting for this, how should Christians think about taking it?
I think you shouldn't take it. I mean, and I understand, you know, there can be people who are in a really difficult financial position who look at it and say, you know, the government has impacted me, their decisions have impacted me, and so I feel like I'm just taking back some of my money that they've stolen from me. I understand those positions, but I think in the end, I do think it's perfectly reasonable to say I'm not going to be a part of my government's sin. I'm not going to encourage my government to do this. I'm not going to accept the bribe that they've given me. I'm going to send it back. I'm going to make sure that I contact my representative and let them know that I'm not voting for them because they've done this, because they've encouraged this. I mean, I think that's a perfectly reasonable position to take.
No, I think it gets kind of complicated. I was reading this week that you can deduct, like if they get your payment wrong or if you don't get your stimulus payment, you can deduct that it's a tax credit. Well, what other tax credits are there? The government has a whole lot of tax credits that are, if it's a, you know, stimulus is one tax credit and, you know, child tax credit, on and on and on, hundreds of tax credits that there could be, you know, those are also the government taking value and that you would owe normally based on their rules and saying, well, you don't need to pay that money. Effectively, a stimulus payment for people having children and for donating to charity and for all these different things. So, you know, not to, there are lines, and I'm not trying to muddy it up and say we can never draw a line anywhere, because I think, you know, there are places to draw lines. But our culture is filled with unjust wage and measures, filled with the government overstepping its authority, and filled with welfare. You know, even government regulation ends up being the same thing. You know, if you need a license to cut hair, well, that is the government helping out the barbers, because you have to go through barber school, makes it harder right to get in. So there's, we just have to realize how filled our culture is with this.
So I do have a question related to that, which is, you know, the child tax credit, going back to 1 Peter, right? It's to reward those who do good. The child tax credit, the government is saying it's good to have children. So couldn't that be interpreted as a reward to those who do good? the deduction for charitable contributions, which is very different than a tax credit, because I mean, just a tax deduction is very different than a tax credit. But the tax deduction for charitable contributions, couldn't you say that's a reward for doing good? I'm not saying I'm for these things. I'm just saying that right. you could say a man that was a righteous man could be taking that verse and interpreting it that way potentially. Is there an argument for the stimulus being in that same category as a reward for those who do good?
I mean, I think that's harder. One line that I would draw is if we're talking about tax credits, where you are getting money from the government that you did not give to them, effectively. I mean, there's different terms. And like if I send the government no money this year, which for almost half of Americans is half of households pay zero taxes. So I would say those people, you should not be taking money from the government. Now, I think it's a different question. It gets more complicated when you, like, let's say I paid $5,000 in taxes this year, and so I'm not going to get money back, more than $5,000. But if I take $2,000 of stimulus, now I have only paid the government $3,000. So, and I think a good argument could be made to say, well, you know, if you add it all up, I am still paying a bunch of money to the government for them to use it for wicked things. And so for me to take this money could be okay. I think that's a good argument could be made. You can add on to that, if I know I have $100,000 sitting in a bank account and that money is inflated, or I have money in bonds, or you know, all kinds of different areas it could fall into, I think you could say, well, this $600 is just a tiny fraction of the money they stole from me by this particular bill.
It becomes kind of a prisoner's dilemma sort of situation. If we all gave the stimulus checks back, if we all applied it towards the national debt,
right,
then we would all be in the same boat.
Though, if you look at the actual bill, you know, this is another level of the bribery. The $600 is like a small percentage of the bill. So even if we all gave our $600 back, we would still be that 20% inflation, you know, that would now only be 18% or something. So it still would be, you know, a lot of money being taken from us, even without the $600.
But I do think it's valid. I mean, so one of the things that we talked about is if this is a bribe, and what a bribe does is it perverts judgment. One of the hardest things for a person to do is actually be honest with themselves about whether something is perverting their judgment, just because that's sort of the nature of the beast. And so, I mean, there's this part of it where you think about it. You go to a restaurant and something bad happens with your meal, and you get angry. Like the restaurant has done something really bad. And then the person comes over, and it doesn't take much. It takes very, very little. I mean, if you think back over yourself, how little does it sometimes take to remove your anger? And I'm not saying you should be fundamentally angry at restaurants, but I'm saying where you say, you've done me wrong, and obviously you go, oh, well, I mean, that takes care of it.
A free dessert? Oh, yeah.
Right. And so there is this part of it where, I mean, I do think that's – I mean, so if you set aside everything else, if you set aside how much you're paying to the government, how much – how upset would you be with the government's actions and their injustice without the money?
And I have not been in favor of stimulus, you know, forever. But you know, I mean, I can even feel they're sending me money, even though I know money is being taken. You know,
right.
I know I'm not gaining anything by this money. You know, I can feel the attraction of, well, if I take this is money, this is great.
And I mean, a friend of mine works at a car dealership, and he said after the stimulus checks came out, that car dealership had their best month ever. No other month was close to it. We look around and building of houses is booming. And we should think about that, because that means there are people who may never have had a new car in their life before. All of a sudden they have two kids and they have two adults and what was the previous one? $1,500. So they have $6,000 and they can go buy a new car for the first time in their life. They have money for a down payment on a house. And every time they drive that car, every time they go into that house, they go, this wouldn't have happened without the stimulus. And they might go, in theory, I'm against it, but bribes work.
Right.
And we should be really careful, because bribes work. Even the righteous man goes, yeah, this is a nice car. I never would have gotten this except this bribe. And they don't call it a bribe. They call it a stimulus check. The stimulus check I got from the government.
Right. And in the end, you start telling yourself a set of stories of who really got hurt. you know, it maybe it hurt the banks. Maybe it hurt the, you know, I mean, you start, you know, I mean,
it hurt the rich because they're the ones that had money in the bank that was deflated.
Right. And so it's a common thing. I mean, it's like if you watch movies about things like this, you know, they'll talk about, you know, we're just going to stick a couple. It's just a bunch of ones and zeros moving through the internet, and we're just going to stick it in, and it's not, nobody's actually going to get hurt. And this is how you justify sin. This is how you justify evil. This is how a man has an affair. This is how, I mean, all of these things, this is what happens. And so, I mean, I think there's a part of it where it's the hardest thing for a person to do is to be honest about themselves, to actually look at yourself and saying, yeah, my judgment's been perverted. I mean, the memes that I saw on Facebook right after the stimulus was coming out was, it was Walmart, we hear you're getting a $600 check, and it was a series of TVs being sold for $550, $600, you know, it was right at the price point.
They had it wrong, right? It was Amazon.
Right.
I mean, this whole thing has been a huge giveaway for Amazon, a huge giveaway.
You know, the first stimulus check, the one that we got back in the summer, it was given out to people at the time when across the country lockdowns were at their height, when local governments were really saying, you have to stay home. You know, I mean, they're still saying that now, but it's kind of relaxed. But they were really enforced then. But all of a sudden, here's this check that's supposed to stimulate local economies and local small businesses that you can't go to. You couldn't go to those restaurants, which are all closed now. You couldn't spend your money there. So where did you spend it? Well, you spend it at large online retailers like Amazon.
Or large offline. I mean,
or you went and you bought a car in Walmart.
You could go to Lowe's. You could go to the big box stores. It was the small stores where, I'm sorry, your store's too small. You can't have any customers in it. And so it didn't stimulate the small businesses. It was a transfer of wealth from the small businesses to the large businesses in a lot of ways.
It was a transfer of wealth from businesses that were forced to close to businesses that weren't.
Mm-hmm. I think one additional complication here is because Scripture has very harsh words against bribery. But in the Hebrew, there's no difference between the word for bribe and the word for gift. And Scripture is clear that, you know, a father gives good gifts to his children. So gifts are okay, bribes are not okay, and it's the same word. So there's not some red line clear between bribe and gift. It's a judgment call.
I could say there's probably a lot of soft-hearted politicians out there. They're soft-headed too, who think we're just giving a gift to the American people, especially the people at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. They really need it. I mean, you know, there's problems with that we've been spending the whole evening discussing. Number one, hey, they're the government. They shouldn't be doing this. They shouldn't be giving those kinds of gifts. That's not within their responsibilities. And then number two, they're not actually giving you anything. It might look like something, but it disappears in the market.
And fundamentally, when God gives good gifts, which like you said, it's the same word. When God gives good gifts, he's giving gifts to cause our judgment not to be perverted.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's a good gift.
That's the red line.
A good gift is that it stimulates us to think godly about the world rather than ungodly about the world, right? I mean, that's a gift. When you give your children, if you're doing something that causes them to sin, don't do it. It's not a good gift. But God gives good gifts, gifts that inspire holiness rather than gifts that inspire sin. So when we think about this, we do need to think about it in that light because it is a temptation to sin. It is a temptation to say what they're doing is okay and what they're doing is not okay. And I think there's another aspect to that too is they see everybody accept the checks and they go, this must have worked.
Right.
I bribe people successfully. I'm more likely to get elected next time. And it is a real thing that the briber can't tell. It's not like you're bribing a jury, that the jury afterwards, you find out whether the guy was innocent or not to figure out if your bribe worked. The only way they read whether the bribe worked or not was, do people seem happy with it? Did they take the checks? Are they complaining about it?
Right.
And so one thing that I would argue is, to some extent, even more than taking the money or not taking the money, is to say, I'm not going to vote for you because you attempted a bribe. And we should make it clear to them that the bribery doesn't work.
You mean actually contacting the offices of your congressman?
Yes.
And telling them,
you voted for this. You believe in bribing. I'm, you know, how dare you
or,
try to bribe
hey,
me?
I mean, there's a vote upcoming. Presumably, if Biden actually gets into office and in a peaceable fashion here in the next couple days, then...
Well, one of the Democratic senators said he's not going to go for it, so we'll see if he can get the vote or not.
So, yeah, but you know, assuming that a vote comes up, or we know that there's a vote on the table for this, that's the time to call right now. Right. Say, if you vote for this, I will never vote for you. I will never approve of your reelection.
And the church needs to stop acting like it doesn't have responsibility in the matter. Because the church is the light of the world. It has to be the one saying, don't take bribes. It has to be the one saying, you understand, when you take bribes, your judgment is perverted. And I do think there's some legitimacy to what Josh was saying, so I'm not eliminating it entirely. But of the idea of, I paid all these taxes, why shouldn't I get some of my own money back? Which is a summary of what he said. There is that, but at the other end, or what the church needs to be saying is, think about it like a bribe and make sure you're, if you take it, that you're thinking about it of, this is a refund about money that was already taken that shouldn't have been taken, versus this is somehow the government's blessing me. The government's not blessing you. They're bribing you.
So there might be people out here listening to this who, you know, they don't pay federal taxes. They're not going to argue that they can take and get their money back. So we're telling them to not take the money. And, you know, there are people out there who have lost their job, and maybe they're homeless because of, you know, losing their job about through the shutdowns. So what are we saying to them? You know, how can we justify to them, don't take this money?
The government is not your provider. God is your provider. If you walk in righteousness, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. If he gives you a cow, he gives you the real cow. He doesn't just make fake cow for you, right? I mean, he doesn't inflate stuff. He can actually make value. And God provides for his people. God blesses righteousness. God blesses faithfulness. God blesses obedience. And so trust God.
I think when we started this, one of the things we said was the government sees God judging, and the government says, we want you to turn to us. And there's this part of it where when you see that money, you hold on to that money because so there's this part of it where the impassioned plea, the principled plea would be, God's a better banker than the world.
And last time you had something where you're talking about like your experience with this, do you remember that?
I think so.
I if you could do that, I thought that was pretty
Make
good.
Up that story again.
I mean, I do remember specifically, I mean, in my own life, there was a time period where, you know, we had medical bills. You know, my daughter had been burned. We went into I just don't know how many medical bills we had. And basically, I'd come to the point where I basically decided, I'm going to be poor for the rest of my life. And I think and God actually brought me to a point where I actually made peace with the fact of, you know what, I'm going to be poor for the rest of my life. This is what's ahead of me. This is the work I have. This is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to take joy in this, and I'm going to take pleasure in this. And I remember that. I remember casting my cares on God. I remember, you know, calling out to him. But I also remember saying, this is okay if this is what it is. And it wasn't very long after that. I mean, it was a very short time after that God moved things. He began taking those debts off of me. He began making ways for me to make more money. I mean, and not small amounts more money. I mean, I remember going from, you know, looking at $1,000 extra in a year being a really big thing to, you know, $10,000 being much more. I mean, God changed things in a drastic way. And this is not some sort of prosperity gospel. This is not, you know, if you just put your trust in God, he'll take care of everything. But I do mean there is a reality to the fact of God brings things into your life. He puts things in front of you. He gives you difficulties. And your attitude towards them and your attitude towards him really do matter. Do you actually look to God as the one who provides for you? Are you actually pleased and content with what he's given you? Or are you looking for some way out other than through him? And that's what the government is there. They're ready to give you a trinket. They're ready to give you a toy, a thing that will become less valuable the second they give it to you. And that is not what God gives.
I remember when I preached on lay up treasures in heaven, because I'd heard it preached on before, and it was always preached on that you will get your reward in heaven. But when you start to examine the passage, that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about you'll get your reward on earth. It's better than a bank.
Right.
If you have money and you give it to the poor, God can provide you more. God is the one who decides what you receive. And so if you walk in faithfulness, if you walk in righteousness, God can give you a lot more. And what we go is, well, if I take that bribe, I'll have more. And the reality is God also does, you know, talks about in Malachi about you don't give me money and I'll put you, have you put your money in a bag with holes in it. And that's what God does when you take unrighteous money that you think that somehow it's going to make you better off. God can make it so that you're worse off. As a nation, God has been doing this as a house went from $5,000 to $150,000. God does this. He makes us put money in bags with holes. When we say, we'll get rich, we'll just inflate the currency, no, we just get poor. And that's, we did a war on poverty and we've become poor as a nation. And we think that if you trust God's word, which says lay up treasures in heaven, don't trust the money God will provide, then all of a sudden we think we'll be poor. Well, guess what? God's proven it the other way. Why don't you try God and see if God does it? God does what he says.
And this is the nature of idolatry. Is the people who follow after idols, they go into them because they believe they'll bring them prosperity. They believe they will bring, you know, or they'll remove evil from their life. And so there's this part of it where, I mean, when they go by the house of false worship, and if you look, the world says, this is how you become wealthy. And they want to tell you how to become wealthy. They want to tell you what things. And as Christians, we believe that all means are God's, that God is in control of every secondary mean. And there's a point where you ask yourself, do I really believe that? I remember watching, going from a, you know, there was a point where I looked at what I did causing a deal to close. And there's a point where God looked at me and said, do you understand? Do you really think fundamentally that it is purely your striving?
Trust me, I never thought that.
But there is this part of it where, I mean, it's, you know what I mean? You can be that foolish. You can be that deluded into thinking that it's all purely your striving that causes these things to happen.
And when God's disciples, right, when they come to Jesus Christ and say, teach us how to pray, he says, right, give me this day, my daily bread. We should daily remind ourselves. This is one of the reasons we give thanks at meals, is to remind ourselves, yeah, we labored because we were commanded to labor, but it's God who gave the increase. And if we forget that, then we go, well, this $600 stimulus check will make me wealthier. And the right answer is the $600 stimulus check will make you poorer.
So for people out there who had direct deposited or had it already cashed their check, what should they do? Is it too late?
That's a good question. One thing I would say is that I have heard of people that contacted their bank and said, don't allow this transfer in. And some banks have honored that. I don't know that all will. So one thing is with this next round coming is that you can stop now. You can try to stop it now. And then there's the question of what do you do with it?
I mean, there is a Treasury, U.S. Treasury fund to reduce the debt. And so I think if you send it back to that, that'd be about the closest you could get to not cashing the check.
Yeah, I know somebody who's, I believe they've actually, they have, I believe they either have done that or they're doing that. They called to make sure that if you sent the check in to that, that it would be applied to that fund and that it would go into that fund. And then they were contacting their local representatives to let them know the issue that they had with it.
And that's what I would also encourage people to do, is make sure you contact your local representative and send a copy of it and go, I sent this check back because I don't want your bribe. You don't have to use those words, but you should use words that explain to your representative why you don't want to accept this check. Because it's by shining light that the darkness flees. Darkness flees from the light. When the church doesn't shine the light, we can just expect to get more of it rather than less.
I mean, one of the other things is I think there are a lot of times where we talk to our children about decisions that you can make and what it means to make decisions by faith and what it means to walk by faith. And there are these opportunities that come up that are like this, that actually are the opportunities. You know, when you're a kid, you imagine scenarios where it's you against the world and you have this pivotal moment. But the truth is the pivotal moments look a lot more like this. The pivotal moments look a lot more like basically someone is trying to give you money and you're in a position of authority to actually refuse and you want to take it. I mean, that's the trap. That's the danger. These are moments that actually look like walking by faith or not. And so, I mean, if you want to talk to your kids about it, if you want to actually be able to tell them about a decision that you made that actually was walking by faith, this is a good example of that. And it's a good example to look at in your own life and say, do I really walk by faith? Because very few of us are going to be standing face to face with someone putting a gun in front of us. Very few of us are going to have to, you know, stand in front of people and stand in front of a firing squad and take a bullet. But this is a question of, do I actually believe these things? And there's a direct causal chain between who God is, who we say God is, how we believe he provides, the place of government. And we can talk about it, we can post about it, we can put memes, we can rage. But at the end of the day, you have a decision to make and you actually have a position of authority. And what are you going to do?
It's really easy to read Proverbs where it says, you know, come share a purse with me. You know, we'll go and rob people. Come share a purse with me.
Right.
But the reality is all Americans are being told that. Come share a purse with us. We're going to rob the people that have wealth, rob the value, and we're going to share the purse. And the person who shares the purse with the thief, they don't get richer. They just get the judgment of being a thief with them. So we should just be careful. We should, and I understand that there's other considerations about the taxes you pay and the depreciation of your currency and your value and all that stuff. But in the end, the government is whispering, come share a purse with me. And we should be really careful.
I mean, one other thing that's really relevant too is if you are poor, if you are struggling, you should go to your church. I mean, if you do not have money to put food on the table, if you don't have money for clothes, you should go to your church. And that was one of the things that I was thinking about is when there were times I had to go to people when God brought me low and I had to expose my need to them. And it was humbling. But the truth is part of the reason why the government does this is the government wants to say, we've kept you from being humbled. But if God's humbling you, look at David whenever Absalom casts him out. Someone's throwing rocks at him, and David says, don't stop him because maybe God will see me being humbled in this state. It's not a shame. I mean, what's shameful is when God decides to humble you and you're unwilling to be shamed. You're unwilling to be humbled by his hand. And God is merciful. I mean, so I think there's this part of it where some of these things going on that we've kept the church from doing what the church should do. But one of the ways we've done it is that people don't go to their church. People don't come and say, this is where God has put me. And it may be because of my sin, and it may be because of the, you know, and they're not willing to bear that shame and actually be dealt with. And the church isn't willing to actually help people in their time of need. But I think that's something that actually needs to happen.
And God says there'll be food in his house. God says he'll provide. He has the cattle on 1,000 hills. He doesn't have any limit of resources. And maybe you go to a church that doesn't have any money. But the reality is, then that church should go, why don't we have any money? And we want to think, and maybe it's they went and got a mortgage and they're spending money on things that God doesn't approve of. But that's a blessing to that church too. Because it's not a lack of resources of God. It's never a lack of God's resource. He has everything in his hand. And so it's always what God is choosing to give resources. If he's not choosing to give you resources, you should be asking the question, why?
You should be asking him. I mean, you should be asking God why. And he, and like you said, you should be looking at yourself. But pour out your cares to God and actually look at yourself.
We want to leave you with just the thought of, our country has gone in a lot of directions that are very unbiblical and very unrighteous. And we need to recognize where that comes from. That comes from the heart of man. And that comes from men, and especially the church, that doesn't want to listen to God's ways and wants to choose to go its own ways. They see that $1,500 or that $600 and they go, we want this money. Instead of going, what is right in the sight of God? If we want our country to heal, the men who are called, the men and women who are called by God's name, they need to humble themselves and turn from their wicked ways. That's how the land gets healed. And as we think about it and think about what the government's doing, let's ask ourselves, how do we turn from our wicked ways? Because that is the solution.
This has been The Conquering Truth, a project of Reformation Baptist Church. If you found this helpful, you can visit us online at theconqueringtruth.com. And subscribe in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.